Today's edition of the Between the Ropes podcast is brought to you by Suplex Apparel. Don't know who they are? Well, they're a UK-based clothing brand. They make great gear that you will love. And right now is the right time of year for you to go check them out online at suplexapparel.com. Holidays are right around the corner. You got gifts that you want to buy. You got things that you want for yourself. And as a wrestling fan, it can be tough to find good-looking wrestling gear. Suplexapparel.com has that just for you. It's pro wrestling focused clothing for wrestlers and for fans. They work with a team of professional wrestlers, guys like Adam Cole, Zack Sabre Jr., Prince Devitt, Kyle O'Reilly, the new ROH champion, and others. And right now, the winter range is out. That means they've got jackets, hoodies, hats, rucksacks, t-shirts, and more, and for both men and women. And they ship worldwide. Don't wait any longer if you want to get it for the holiday season, since that's coming up. You better go right now to suplexapparel.com, get your gear for friends, family, anybody that you care about, and get some for yourself as well. Become part of the Suplex Apparel team. Check them out online at suplexapparel.com. Well, joining me today is Ian Frisch, the journalist who wrote the fantastic investigative piece for Vice Sports on the WWE. It's titled Breaking Kayfabe, an Inside Look at WWE's Unlikely Business Empire. First of all, Ian, congratulations on the piece.
Thank you so much. Been a long time coming.
How long exactly did you work on this?
I had first brought the idea to my editors at Vice. Back in, I want to say February or late January, about around that time, you're starting to hear hype for WrestleMania, especially Vince and the WWE in general kind of going around touting that they're going to break the attendance record. And there was a lot of buzz about that and how The Rock was going to be there. He was having such a breakout year in terms of Hollywood. So it kind of piqued my interest. And I said, you know, maybe we should look into the rise of WWE as a business. But I didn't really start reporting on it until I got to WrestleMania in April.
So had you been a wrestling fan or a WWE fan prior to working on this piece?
I mean, as a kid, you know, like a middle schooler, I was a hardcore fan. I loved it. I mean, that was like prime Attitude Era. You know, I was a big Stone Cold guy. I loved Kane as a kid. You know, it was one of those phases for me that, you know, still sticks out as like a, you know, core aspect of my childhood. But I had honestly fallen off and hadn't showed any interest in it at all until I started seeing it back in the mainstream and kind of coming at it more from a journalistic perspective rather than that of a fan. Cause it still very much intrigued me that it was, growing and, broadening its scope, more so than it had, back in the '90s and, early 2000s.
Yeah, because it's amazing, like, how much in the mainstream WWE is nowadays. Was it a hard sell to your editor to do a piece like this?
No, definitely not. Only because there was a void in kind of like the mainstream media, if you want to call it that, where the way people were reporting on WWE, a lot of it was just, you know, like, I wouldn't say regurgitation, but a lot of it was just coming off of press releases from the company. And then if anything was happening regarding finance or, you know, anything that could like connect to the mainstream in the business capacity, you would see that, or like WrestleMania would come about. But the way I kind of wanted to approach it was, let's go deeper. Let's see what the company's really like, you know, why have they become so successful? What have the past few years been like for them? How are they holding their cultural relevance, et cetera, et cetera. And kind of go at it more with the intention of doing a deep dive rather than just kind of like a topical kind of like, you know, play by play about what's going on with the company now, which is pretty much what you would see in other news outlets.
So you got a chance to speak with some of the particulars in the company when it came to this piece. So what was the reaction when you told them that you were working on this, and what kind of access did they give you?
Well, at first, you know, I had told them that I wanted to go to WrestleMania and just kind of see the spectacle for what it was. And it was incredibly impressive. It was remarkable. I had never been to a live wrestling event of any kind. You know, I used to watch the pay-per-views when I was a kid, and, you know, even then it was definitely surprising at how amazing they looked, but being there in person was a whole different thing. So what I had originally, you know, I said I wanted to do a really big story on WWE, the business, the history, where it's going, what the insides of the company look like, and what makes it relevant now. And WrestleMania was right around the corner, so the first logical step was to have me come down there. So they, you know, I made requests like, I want to talk to Stephanie, I like to talk to John Cena or any of the wrestlers who could speak to certain aspects of the company or their view on being a wrestler or being involved in this corporation. And WWE was fairly open to that. What kind of turned was that when I got back, you know, I had this, you know, this vision of the company on the surface, this glitzy, you know, very brand heavy, over the top product that people love and they have fallen in love with and stayed dedicated to. I mean, I mentioned in the piece talking to children at Access, which is kind of like the fan convention that runs throughout the weekend during WrestleMania, and, you know, talking about the types of people there and people who are dedicated to NXT, which I did a lot of writing about in this piece, because that's been such a huge push for the brand in a different way that's never been seen before. But, you know, when I started to try to ask WWE, let me talk to Michelle, let me talk to George Berrios, you know, I'm looking at a lot of the numbers, you know, for the network and other aspects of the financials that to me are kind of like raising questions or like, oh, this looks kind of, you know, maybe isn't lining up with, you know, this, I'm speaking to other sources about the company. And, you know, I think, once they realized that I was going deep in a very objective way, you know, I wasn't going in there to write a hit piece. I wasn't going in there to write a puff piece. I wanted to kind of tell it how it was. And once I got to that layer of my reporting and research, because I called dozens of people to talk about the company, I think they kind of understood that I was going to report the facts as they lay. So I did get some pushback towards the end of this reporting cycle, for sure.
Did you get close to speaking with Vince?
No, I didn't. I'm not even sure if I made a request for Vince, to be honest with you, because I knew that they wouldn't have agreed, and I don't really think it was necessary. You know, I think that the people who really know what's like, I'm talking the hardcore nuts and bolts of the company, are people that tell Vince. You know, Vince is good at what he knows, you know, but if you want to talk nuts and bolts finance, or you want to talk the inner workings of the expansion on like a ground level, you want to talk to people like George Berrios or Michelle Wilson, you know? So those were the people, and also Paul and Stephanie. So those are the people who I really wanted to kind of dig into more, because I think those are the voices you hear from less in the mainstream, especially.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the only time you ever hear from George Berrios is on these conference calls, it seems like, and even those are going to be short, and it's only investors that are basically speaking on that, or a few journalists, and you never hear from Michelle. So in doing this piece, I mean, there's a lot of different layers. There's a lot of different parts to it. What was the biggest takeaway for you?
Well, again, I'm not a smart mark or anything. You know, I wasn't this guy who came in saying, I know a lot about the company already and I'm going to connect all the dots. So when I started digging into this, and I think this is one of the reasons why it took me so long, aside from the fact that I wanted to wait until the second quarter notes and the SEC documents were released to kind of get a sense about WrestleMania's success. But it kind of allowed me, I think, a fresh lens into the company because I was someone who was completely unfamiliar. So starting from, like I said, the topical layer about this big brand, you have Roman, this new face, he's coming to the top, Triple H is still in there, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But as I went through the layers, it was all this new, fresh information for me, which allowed me to, I think, frame the piece in a more objective way that could say, okay, all these sort of layers intersect and intertwine in some way. But I think the main takeaway that I came to realize, and I think the whole point of the article is it all connects back. And I think that Brian Gewirtz had the best quote on it, was that all this expansion, you know, this push for international dominance, you know, the over-the-top network, the NXT, you know, all these things, some of which have proven successful, but especially the network, which seems like a very risky, but also it's necessary to jump head first with something like that. It's like a lot of it is like, well, are you able to sustain this sort of ambition? Because before it was very much like Vince took over the national wrestling subculture and the whole commerce that went around it. He owned the industry. You know, he was the only game in town. Like I say in my piece, the rules of the game have now changed, you know? And I think that trying to dominate a field that you're unfamiliar with when it comes to over-the-top networks and straight-to-consumer streaming services, especially when you're starting to navigate international markets so fast, too, so fast, with a crew of people who, from what I had researched and found out, so many bits and pieces of turnover, you know, all these people coming in from traditional TV and other parts of digital media and then getting fired or quitting, et cetera. It's like, I was like, whoa, it's like, to me, the biggest takeaway is WWE, especially Vince McMahon, has always been an ambitious enterprise. But is that ambition going to be its greatest downfall moving forward?
Yeah, that was one of the things that I've always wondered about, too, was I understood why they went headfirst into the WWE network doing, you know, an over-the-top model. But at the same time, I've always wondered, did they do it too early? Were they too quick into this, considering that a lot of it was based on pay-per-view, which they thought was dying? And pay-per-view has not died, especially for a company like UFC. So I guess the question then is, do, you know, being as ambitious as Vince is and this company is, are they trying to do too much too soon? And that was something that Brian Gewirtz had kind of alluded to without flat out saying it. And there's also a quote in the piece where it says investors feel like the company overpromises and underdelivers. And that comes to, you know, with some of the projections that they have and then some of the numbers that you actually see in the SEC filings, especially when it comes to the WWE network.
Yeah, and it's, I'm not like faulting them for trying. You know, I think it's a very noble and kind of obvious move for the company to say, well, look at everything else. Like, who's succeeding and who's failing? Like, it's pretty simple math here, right? And that's always been kind of Vince's thing, I think, you know, in terms of how he views what the company should do and what they shouldn't do. Is it working or is it not? Like, a very black and white thing. And I think that's the company culture as well as his own personal mindset, basically about everything. And it's about not only that, but about if he thinks it's going to work or not. So you have to realize that, like, even going back to like early decisions with the company and their expansion, when the company was like putting a lot of effort into social media, like they had really got on social media pretty early and they have definitely seen massive growth in that digital media sphere in terms of corralling a large audience. I can't say it's profitable, but they definitely have done that. So to Vince and WWE, they've seen big numbers and then they think it's successful. And I think that with the network, they were kind of on the same thought path in terms of we can get the numbers up, then we can make it seem like it's a success and everything's okay. And then we can sustain, hopefully, that all the extra fat and padding will come in over time. But again, it's like once you embark on this, you're not only adjusting how the business operates from the inside, but you're adjusting how you want your consumer to view the business in which you run. For me, for the longest time, it's like wrestling was always there on on USA or the other networks that carried the weekly program. You could flick through and see it and watch for a little bit, or if you followed every week, you could check back in, or, you know, they, and then you wait for the pay-per-view and you pay for it and, you know, whatever. But then it's like, you're changing the whole model about how people interact with your product, which is a much more drastic change than, say, putting more money into a specific department. You're almost changing the type of business that you're running and the product that you're putting out there.
Yeah, and it's not like the network has not been a success. I think the question about it is, why isn't it as successful as they thought it was going to be right off the bat? And this is one of these things where you jump into something as early as they did, and they went headfirst into it, like you said, the piece. But, you know, it takes time. It's taking longer time than they thought it was going to be. And this is a changing market. And it's something that is totally new for them to go from just this traditional wrestling company to being this all-encompassing entertainment company to what they are now. And there's so many balls that are in the air and trying to judge this and go forward. That's the difficult part. And then on top of that, you've got one guy that everybody looks at and says, you know, yes, he is the guy in charge in Vince McMahon, but at the same time, he's got his hands on everything and he likes to micromanage, which can make it difficult for people too.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many variables that will dictate a successful digital product. And to be able to go out there and say, we've never done this before, but it's going to be wildly successful, is almost naive, if not like downright false, you know? So when WWE started saying that they're going to, you know, break even immediately and they're going to sustain and all this stuff, I mean, and it's not going to affect any other of their platform arms, like, I mean, it's obvious to me that that's not the case. And although George Berrios told me over and over again, the content doesn't compete. It doesn't compete. It's all different, you know? And it's just like, well, the timeline doesn't say that to me, you know? And that was one of the things where I'm like, they come out with the network, it hurts the TV deal, Vince admitted it, and then the paid subscribers for the network are fluctuating all up and down. I mean, they're steadily going up over time, but still it's like, have you already hit your ceiling? Like, you know, and that's why they rolled out international so fast to try to, like, you know, try to make back some of that money lost. But again, it's like, this is a huge move for a company that was traditionally just a wrestling, you know, a single vessel interaction. You know, you turn your TV on and it's there, right? But now it's like you have this whole other vessel. It's better for the company to own all their own content, for sure. So they can have everything in their own library and they can put on their network and et cetera. But you're forcing people now to pay a mandatory $10 a month for something that they may not view as being necessarily worth that monthly fee, because WWE and Vince has always wanted to be an entertainment behemoth. He never really just wanted to be like a wrestling outfit. You know, he wanted to be this international, like, you know, mega corporation that was entertainment, that transcended the boundaries and the stereotypes of the traditional wrestling consumer. And I think that with WWE Network, that was like the ticket to that goal being fulfilled, because it allowed them to latch onto a business model that proved successful with other companies like Netflix and Hulu and et cetera. But also it allowed them to kind of break the walls of their own, of the confines of the subculture in which they created, which is a hard thing to do. And it's very ambitious and it can still be done. I just think it's going to be a little bit more delicate than they originally thought. And I think that they're going to have to come to some hard truths about their consumer. You know, if people can flick through and watch wrestling a couple days a week and be kind of interested in it, you know, then that's fine. And they're always going to have that TV kind of interaction. But then if you're going to say, well, if you want the entire experience, you have to pay $10 a month, you know, it's psychologically different, you know? And I think that they maybe have overstepped their ability to wrangle their potential audience, you know, which I have a graph in my article, which, you know, has this projection of over 150 million, you know, broadband households who would want their product, who would be willing to pay $10 a month. And it's just like, it's just a little too vague to make that assumption, especially so early on, you know? So I think it's a bigger picture change for the company than just saying, here's a new way to consume WWE content.
It is, you know, and the thing is, too, when it comes to WWE, we talk about it, you know, it's talked about in the story about, you know, kind of the structure of everything, which is very unique. I mean, this business alone is extremely unique. As somebody that has never, that didn't cover WWE previously, and seeing the way that business is done behind the scenes, and kind of seeing the structure of it, how demanding it is, how the changes that happen all the time, have you ever seen another business remotely run like this?
Not really. I mean, and the one thing that I mentioned in the article that seemed jumped out to me was the tapering of responsibility, right? When you have a corporation of this size, with this much money behind it, there's a, it's almost like a big oak tree. You know, you had your trunk, which are the top dogs, but there are so many branches that come off of that that do their own thing, and they all feed the trunk, and everyone's trusted, and that's the whole point. You know, that's the whole point, is to have really talented people doing their respective jobs. And I think it'd be in WWE's best interest to follow that model. But again, when you have someone who has owned the company and been able to operate it as if it's a dictatorship, basically for 3+ decades, it's going to be hard for that person, Vince McMahon, to let go of that sort of system as the company grows larger, which is kind of this weird kind of like oxymoron, if you want to, or put it that way, where it's like he wants the company to be as big as it can be, but he still wants to run it as if it's a small regional outlet, which is kind of strange because he has the ability to get some really kick-ass people in there to do the work that needs to be done. But as some people had attested, you know, Donna Goldsmith, who was the former COO, she's like, once you're in Vince's line of sight, like, you know, it can become very difficult, you know, and he can just be kind of over you, you know, he can let his emotions kind of overtake it. And the more ex-employees I called, the more people spoke to that. And I mean, I think a lot of people who follow wrestling understand that Vince isn't the most diplomatic of people.
No.
But I think that, and that's fine. You can have an asshole boss, and that's completely okay. I think a lot of businesses are run by people who are a little bit more stern, and that's why their companies do so well, because they're very analytical in their decision making. But when you cross the line and you allow your business to teeter only on a few legs, those who you trust, you know, Kevin Dunn, his daughter, you know, Triple H, Michelle, and George, you're looking at a system that is, you know, everything is fed into these handful of people. And you can see that in the past, they've tried to broaden that. They hired all these outside TV people. They brought in all these other positions that could consolidate some of the workload and oversee different branches of the company. And then at the end of the day, fire them, consolidate all of the oversight into Michelle and George, or Triple H, or Stephanie, much less Stephanie now, I think, in a lot of respects. But ultimately, Vince just wants more control over what's going on in his company. And if he can funnel that control through the couple people that he trusts, he's going to be better off. But, you know, like we've seen, it just creates turmoil. And I think a lot of people who work there see that as fairly obvious.
And I think there's a lot of people that come in there with one idea, especially where people that have worked in entertainment and come in there to be a part of the creative process. And they come in there and they're not fulfilled creatively necessarily, because it is going to be Vince. Come the end of the day, you have to go in there, like you said in the piece, and you've got to understand that this is Vince's baby. You might have like this great idea, but if he doesn't like it, that's the way it's going to be. The turnover rate is very high, especially in that department. You know, you had said in the piece about, you know, about 18 months, which, you know, for people that follow wrestling like me all the time, you always hear about guys coming and going, especially in that department. Did you get a sense from speaking with anybody that that Vince would ever be open to changing that? And I know, he, like we said before, he likes to have his hands on everything, but this is an ever-changing business, and I wonder what it would take for that to ever happen. If anybody spoke with you about that, like, this might have to happen before we actually see a change in the way that Vince conducts business and runs the company.
I mean, I think one of the quotes that best sums it up from a source who was anonymous is that it's hard for Vince to fix the problem. I'm paraphrasing here, but it's hard for Vince to fix the problem because the problem is him. So when you go into the, when you debate that, like, oh, how could that change? And it's, you know, let's bring this person in. And then it's just, oh, it doesn't work. You know, it's like, it's not really the people you're bringing in or how you're bringing them in or their ideas. It's about Vince's ability to have the power to just say, I don't want you here anymore. So it's like the only way that the creative department is ever going to be able to sustain a core team for a long period of time, some of whom are not going to be just wrestling people their whole lives, is for Vince to just to be more open to change and to understanding that maybe some of the best ideas aren't going to be his. And I think that that's a hard thing for him to do because a lot of the best ideas presumably have come from him in the past, and they have proven very financially successful for him. So I think that it's always going to come down to him thinking that he knows best because it's his company and I made it this far and everything, which is completely fine. But again, you're going to create a specific kind of a company culture by putting that mindset out. And everyone that I spoke to, when I asked, you know, it's very much like there's a very slim chance of this management style changing. There's a lot of people have tried to do it in the past, and obviously it's not worked.
So when we talk about longevity, it's amazing how long Brian Gewirtz actually stayed with the company, which was just shy of 20 years in the role that he had. Another guy that's been there for a long time that's still there is Kevin Dunn. How do you think Kevin has been able to survive as long as he has? Because I know that he's got Vince's ear to some, you know, extent, but at the same time, we know how Vince's mindset can change on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, anytime you're with a company like this, you're going to have your friends and you're going to have others that are not so friendly.
I mean, I think that the one thing Vince, again, this is my speculation, but I think that he admires loyalty. And he admires the dedication and also someone who thinks like him. So when you have someone like Kevin Dunn, who has been with Vince basically since day one, they've kind of helped build the company as like a little bit of like a brotherly team, you know? And also too, you have to realize that this is a family business. So someone like Kevin, who's been there since Shane and Stephanie were kids, seeing them grow up, he was there when Linda was there, you know, someone like Kevin or like Brian, they grew up as men within the company that Vince had built. And I think that Vince holds that dear to his heart. Now that he's an older age, the turnovers become greater because there's more at stake for each employee hired. And Vince, I think, has already found the people that he has instilled his longtime trust in. And also, too, it's about skill. I mean, Kevin has proven very good at his job in terms of running the entire television operation, which is the bread and butter of the company and has been that way since day one. So it's like Vince knows that he needs to make sure that the relationship between him and Kevin is symbiotic and that they both come to the table with equal means. And that's a really good way to run a company, is to keep your most important players happy. And then in turn, they'll keep you happy. Right. So I think that that's probably why you see some of the main players weathering the storm much, much more so than others, because they've proven themselves to a man with super high standards. I mean, Kevin makes the TV show run. Vince doesn't have to worry too much. You know, George crunches the numbers and Michelle's there to help. And she oversees, you know, all the nuts and bolts of how the company runs in like an operational way. And in terms of, you know, keeping ideas flowing for, you know, keeping money in. And it's like, you know, what more else do you need? You know, because to him, he, in his mind, he's the brain of the creative product, you know, Paul Levesque is there with him, Triple H, you know, and Steph throws her two cents in. But, you know, to him, it's like, I need people who can do things that I can't. And when you build those alliances early on, they're going to allow that person to have some staying power in, you know, what seems to most other people a pretty volatile company.
I think the biggest piece of news that came out of this for people that follow WWE very closely was the story about Shane McMahon trying to return in 2012, and he tried to get control of the creative department of the company when there was a time of fluctuation when it came to the company. It was hurting in a rating sense and some other parts, and he wanted to come in, and he wanted to bring in James Frey, who's an author, and he has a content creation company, and they wanted to take over the creative department. So they got a meeting with Vince McMahon, and in the story you talk about how both Triple H and Stephanie were shocked and like, oh my goodness, what's going on here? And he got the meeting, but in the end, Vince decided not to take him up on the offer. Did you ever get a sense of talking to people how serious the pitch was taken by Vince? Like how close he may have come to actually saying, okay, Shane, let's do it, and you can be in charge of this department?
I can't answer that with complete certainty. But I do know that the meeting was a serious thing, you know. I think that Vince, you know, outside of the office could have told his son, you know, look, no, you know, but to have a legitimate meeting on the books is something that at least to me proves that they were considering it. But again, you know, this is a very complex situation because it's a family business and a lot's at stake. So when Shane leaves the company, you know that in his heart he wants to come back. He wants to reclaim some of his blood right in that way. Because, I mean, I think to me it was always that Stephanie, and this is what's really funny to me, is because the opening of my whole piece is this fictionalized presentation of an award to Stephanie, that how she was best embodied, what was best for the company and all this other stuff. But in real life, that's true. Like, she was always much more aligned with Vince's mindset of how a company should be run, you know? And I think that Shane was always kind of fighting for that sort of positioning himself. And he wanted his dad, I think, to, you know, maybe trust him with a more direct hand in how the company should run, or even trying to get a sense of how, you know, potentially the company would be passed on. So I think that, you know, when he left, he had probably in some way tried to figure out a way back in. And I think that when he had brought that meeting on, I would think that Shane had assumed it would be his best shot, because again, his father, as we just spoke about, is well persuaded by things outside of the wrestling world that have proven successful. That's why a lot of these really big time TV people outside of wrestling got jobs at WWE for, you know, for all those years, was because they had done really well outside of wrestling and in the traditional, you know, big time media Hollywood world. And Vince wanted that clout that came with having that sort of accomplishment outside of the world of wrestling. So Shane comes back with this big time author, James Frey, whose book sold millions of copies. And he's like, I got my guy, you know, we want to take over creative. We think we can do a really good job. I know the product. James is a writer, obviously very successful. So Shane didn't come back without his guns loaded. You know what I'm saying? So I think that, it was, you know, it was probably his best shot, you know, but ultimately, and I can't say for sure why Vince did not, you know, accept the offer. I would assume, again, complete assumption, but I would assume after the meeting, Stephanie and Triple H, you know, spoke to him, maybe dissuaded him from doing so, from choosing Shane's option, because you have, you know, Shane then gains more control. Stephanie and Triple H could lose a handle on, you know, the ship's steering wheel in that regard. So, you know, whether Vince had never really been into it but wanted to give his son the benefit of the doubt to pitch himself, or whether he was seriously considering it and then he was at the last minute ditched, I can't be certain. But I do know that it did warrant, a legitimate meeting where they could state their claim and make their case. But, you know, like we said, Shane went dark for a long time publicly, and now he's back. But, you know, it hasn't really been solidified what his role is yet.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, too, because, you know, he is back, but it's in an on-air role. Have you heard if he wants back in a management role and if that's something they would be open to, or is that just kind of a lingering thing that might be out there?
Well, WWE wouldn't comment on Shane, basically, you know, because when I asked them, I was like, hey, did Shane ever come back to the company with any sort of like pitches or, you know, offering help, or did he ever contact Vince or his sister in a legitimate way? Maybe not over dinner, but, you know, like a legit way between 2009 and now. And they were like, no, never. And I was like, really? And they're like, yeah. And I said, well, I have information that he came back with James Frey, blah, 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 the whole story. And they're like, oh yeah, that did happen. And then I follow up, and I'm asking Paul Levesque, and I'm asking them, well, what's his role now? What's he doing? And they were like, and I'm like, well, why did he leave in the first place? All this stuff. And they're just like, we're not going to tell anymore other than that he's just an on-air personality right now. And that's it. So, I mean, I pushed, but I think the only people who know where Shane is going is him, Kevin, Vince, Stephanie, and Paul. Probably George and Michelle as well, but I think something might happen. I don't know what, you know?
Right.
I think there's got to be some tension going on in terms of how many seats are at the table and who's going to be able to sit in them. But I don't want to speculate too much about what's going on now within the family. You know, I had sources speak to what the relationships are like. But in terms of moving forward and Shane's role, you know, all I know is what they told me, and that he's just going to be someone who's on TV as a personality.
Yeah, I mean, I always believed, and a lot of other people did too, that Shane would come back because it is such a family business. It's just when and how. And this still feels like a bit of a kind of a slow play. I think right now it's everybody just kind of getting used to one another again and seeing if there is a role for him and what it might be, where that fits. You know, there is tension between different members of the family, including Vince, because that is a common belief, is that Shane and Vince just had a difference of opinions on how the company was going to move forward. I think Shane saw that it was going to be Stephanie that was going to have a higher part of it. And he has decided time is right. I am going to go. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to make my money and make my way in business my own way. And that's the way it was. So now it's just a question of, can they patch things up? What kind of relationship do you think that Shane and Vince have from a business standpoint? And same with Shane and his sister, Stephanie.
I mean, the thing is, you know, when you have three bulls in a room, they're going to hit horns sooner or later. And that's just how it is. You know, it's just how this family is. And a lot of business families are like, it's not anything that's like completely exclusive to the McMahons.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, you have a lot at stake for this. You know, it's very rare that a company of this size at this time can still be handed down to the children in this way, you know, especially in a very direct way where it's like, once they give you the keys, you can run the damn thing, you know? So I think that as the kids became adults, I could really see it being like, well, who's it going to be? Because it's not going to be both of us, you know? And I think that was the mindset that both of them had kind of taken as they became more involved in the company throughout the 2000s, where it was like, you know, I want to be the person who, you know, is in charge, and I think that Vince, being a father, never really, you know, I can't be certain, but the way it's played out, like, I can't for certain say that he would want to make a decision about who would succeed him. I think that he's still under the impression that he's not going to give up his company to anyone because he's still the guy who knows best. And that's very much him. But in terms of the company, it's like, you know, I had heard that Shane has much more of an alliance with Kevin Dunn, and obviously Paul and Stephanie are married and they kind of have their own little clique. So it's kind of like trying to position yourself in a company where your family members are the ones you have to work with, but also you kind of have to work against in some way, which is, you know, a very complicated type of back end to have to work towards and work around. But, you know, I think that everyone there is very strong-willed, and they're also very talented. They're also very knowledgeable about the wrestling product because they helped invent it. So when you have a lot of people who have that sense of entitlement or that sense of pride when it comes to what they've done and what they've contributed to a subculture that they helped create, you're going to have a lot of difference of opinion, but also a very steadfast dedication to that opinion. And you're going to have a lot less compromise in that regard.
When Shane came back earlier this year and he appeared on WWE television, I know it caught a lot of people off guard, especially fans. It kind of came out of nowhere. Nobody really saw it coming. With the people that you spoke with, did you feel like they were surprised that he returned and has even stuck around in the role that he has right now?
I didn't speak to too many people about him coming back. I did to some, and like the general consensus was, of course he's back, you know, like, just like we had just spoken about, is that you think he was going to leave forever and just give up? Yeah, right. You know, but he had to do it diplomatically. You know, when you try once and you have a more forceful approach, like, hey dad, I got this guy. He's a famous author. I want to take over creative. You know, that's like firing a warhead. You know, and that's why, you know, I had relayed the information from my source who said that Stephanie and Triple H were freaking out because, you know, that's like a surprise attack, you know, the adversary goes away and, you know, it's like a Greek kind of epic, you know, he goes away for years and then comes back with a whole new plan. So I think that Shane had to come back with playing a different game, you know, and kind of be like, hey, I've done pretty well for myself in this area, doing, Chinese television, done okay over there. You know, the company did lose some money, but, you know, I think that overall Vince probably saw it as a successful move for his son. But it's like, hey, how about we put this back into a storyline, and I'll be on TV. That'll really help the ratings and the product. We can do WrestleMania. It'll be huge. You know, like, I think that he played the game a little bit better this time around. And I think that, like you said, it may be kind of like a long-term strategy. And like, you know, but a lot of the sources I spoke to were basically just like, of course he's back. You know, like, there's so much pride into this company because it is their blood, you know. There's nothing else there in terms of family legacy aside from WWE. So, yeah, of course he's back. But in terms of his strategy here, I mean, we can only speculate. But again, I think he's playing a little more delicate than he did in the past.
Yeah, I think he is, too. I think he's kind of biding his time. And like I said before, trying to see how everything is going, how the relationships are working out. It was funny because we, you know, you had this story about how he tried to take over the creative department. When he came back and he did that promo on television and he had this thing about Stephanie and Vince, you know how I saved your butt, you know, and he did this whole thing. Everybody's like, what is he talking about? And come to find out, this was probably what he was talking about. It just, everybody was kind of in the dark, like, they're making something up. They're going on the fly here, you know, whatever, you know, it's not meant for ever. We're allowed to speculate as this part of a storyline that they're doing. And this was actually it that, you know, he was going to come back and he wanted to take over the creative direction of the company. And it just didn't come to fruition, come to find out.
Yeah. I mean, another thing about why this company is so amazing is that they willingly take aspects of their real life and fictionalize them. And I talk about this, and this is such a strange thing that is exclusive to this family and this company and this subculture, where it's like, okay, some crazy shit's happening in our real lives. Let's just put it on TV and act it out, which is so strange, so weird.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine being Shane McMahon and, or Stephanie, and walking into that ring and acting that skit back in February? And but it's actually, most of it is true. You know, like, that just boggles my mind. But I think that that shows the dedication this family has to their product, and also to how malleable it can be, and how well integrated and woven it can be into how the company really operates. Does that have its downfalls? Yeah, because on one side, you're using family strife as a way to promote a product, which is kind of genius, in my opinion, although a little weird to have to put your own personal grievances out there in a fictional way, and people can kind of assume that they are real. Then on the flip, as I pointed out in the article, that when you start to fictionalize aspects of the company, like, where is the line drawn? You know, like the whole WrestleMania numbers and things like that, where it's like, you know, you can say anything you want if it's, you know, while you're on TV and people are listening and this and that. But then it's like, you know, what's really going on behind the scenes in terms of hard numbers that, you know, have to be submitted to shareholders, et cetera, et cetera. But then, you know, to not deviate from the point, yeah, it was pretty miraculous to watch that skit and then do the reporting and come away and be like, that's like almost all true. That's
right.
So weird.
You know, when it comes to the numbers you talked about, and WWE's done this all the time, and they're not the only ones, but especially when it comes to like the WrestleMania numbers, where they reported over 101,000 attendance this year when it was actually between, you know, 74,000 and 86,000. They've done that before. The biggest one is WrestleMania 3, talking about doing over 93,000, you know, in Detroit. And there's also some things when it comes to the WWE network that, you know, they have put out different numbers, or there's some numbers that they won't give out, but there's everything's in the SEC filings. How loose do you think they can play with those numbers, that you, considering they're a traded company, a publicly traded company, when it comes to like, you know, their investors? I mean, or do investors kind of just expect that with it? Or when you were doing this piece, did you find that some of them were surprised by some of the things that came out?
Well, I think that, you know, it's in any company's best interest to promote the numbers in the most positive light that you can manage. And that's why George Berrios like is Vince's best friend.
Right.
Because George can go out there and make shit look like a birthday cake. And he does, and he's really good at that. And he's done that on the phone with me. And I point out that in the article, like, the discrepancies about what George had told me, and also in the same token, what some of the numbers are saying. So it's kind of like, you don't want to talk about this aspect about what the numbers say, but you want to tote it as this. You know, George's whole thing was, as long as the network's growing, we don't care about anything else. And it's like, how is that a reassuring approach to such a monumental shift in the company's, you know, how the company does business? In terms of how shareholders and investors view it, I'm not totally positive. But I can, you know, I think that and someone's going to invest a lot of money in a company like WWE, they're not going to be stupid. They're not going to let the company pull the wool over their eyes. I think they're going to take what they say at these big flashy presentations with a grain of salt. And then they're going to have their people comb through the documents like I did, and find the holes and then question them and see how the company can overcome these obstacles. Because I mean, I don't know about anyone else out there, but I don't want WWE to fail. You know, I want them to succeed, but in being able to succeed, you have to admit your own shortcomings. So it's like, okay, our churn numbers are crazy. Like, what does that mean? What is the psychological mindset of our customer? Why are they signing up and then leaving? What's the most popular content? Where are we putting money that's not giving us a good return? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's like when you talk about social media and you're like, we got billions of views. And we got hundreds of millions of followers and all this stuff. And like, that's all you talk about in terms of your reach on social, but the kickback in terms of money to investment is super low, like embarrassingly low.
It means nothing. I mean, I know that they tout these social media numbers, like, and they put it on their television show. And I understand that they want to have a footprint and they want to brag about it. But at the same time, it's like, okay, that's great, but okay, what does this mean business wise? Can you show that this has made a big difference in business and brought in money? And it really hasn't.
I know, and like I asked George about that explicitly. I'm like, you know, can you prove to me that your huge social media following is making you money? Not correlation, but causation. Like, can you draw the line? And you know, you really couldn't. And it's, you know, a lot of times, and this is not exclusively a problem that WWE has by any means. I mean, right. I'm a journalist. I work for magazines who basically are reliant on social media for traffic. And it's almost like you can't really go anywhere and say you have a billion followers on all your social media. How much money do you make off that directly? Like, how can you prove that that's making you money in terms of ad revenue or whatever? It's a very, it's a very convoluted system of what makes money and what doesn't on the internet. But the way that they submit their documents to the SEC, what I see is that social media and the whole digital media department in general makes them no money. Is it a necessity to have social media presence and to promote your product through that because it's highly visible to the average consumer? Of course. But it's also like when you use that as a justification to launch a network that is very risky, and saying, oh, we have such a big social media footprint and we have all this other stuff that will definitely get people signed up to the network, that's when you cross the line into kind of murky waters, in my opinion. And that's kind of like what I was trying to get at with these numbers, is that WWE Network is sick. To me, it's a great idea, but don't bite off more than you can chew and be honest about it, you know? Like, I'm not, you know, I think that George and Michelle are very smart, And without them, I think the company would be much worse off in terms of this network running properly. But it's also at the same time, like, the more honest you are with yourself in terms of how your business is running and what its downfalls are and what its strengths are, the more likely you are to succeed in the long term. And that's what I kind of got from this, is that maybe they don't want to admit it, but I think that there are flaws in their business plan for this network. And I think that just being like, look, this is where this is kind of iffy. What can we do to plug this hole? I mean, that's all you really have to do moving forward. But again, as time goes on, much more becomes at stake, because the TV deal is going to be renewed in a couple of years. And obviously they're going to say, well, your network's doing so well, you know? But again, imagine that you could watch Raw and SmackDown on the network, but then there's no guaranteed money from a TV deal. Say it was never on TV again, and the only way you could watch Raw or SmackDown or any other WWE product was to pay $10 a month. Could they say with absolute certainty that they could make the same amount of money as they are now with TV and network combined? I don't know. That's the real question. Because in 5-10 years, that's what it's going to come down to.
Right. And when you're making right now $175 million off your television deal, and, you know, you're going to have to make at least that, and who knows what they could get in their next TV deal. I mean, everybody thought that they were going to double on this last one, and they didn't. And there were some investors, if you remember at the time, talking about, oh, well, look at what NASCAR did, and WWE totally believed this too. They were, well, you know, there was, you know, financial experts. Hey, look what NASCAR did. So WWE, they're going to do four times the amount. Because I remember them talking about this, going, oh, they're going to do $450 million on this deal.
And no way.
They didn't sniff that.
No. And that's the thing, is that Vince has always been someone who has succeeded. And that's just been his mindset. He's always succeeded throughout everything that he's tried, basically, more or less. He squashed the competition. He hit a stride with Attitude Era. He created this amazing thing. But now as things become more complicated, when you go out there and saying, we're going to double it, you put me in a hammer lock if I don't. That's a direct quote from Vince. You know, it's like at these investor meetings, it's like, you better check yourself a little bit, because it's obviously not working out in your favor to be so boastful and then to, like, you know, like some of the investors are saying that you're under delivering. So it's like, to me, if I had to speculate, and again, I'm much newer to the understandings of the WWE than some people. But if I had to speculate, I would say that the next TV deal is going to be even less. And I think that the amount of money that a network is willing to give WWE is going to decrease exponentially over time. So this TV deal, you know, they're going to be gaining less and less money every time. And potentially maybe they're going to be offered less than the previous deal. So it's kind of like, at what point are they going to say, should we make the jump to 100% network? And hopefully everyone that watches our product says, oh, we have to sign up now. Because they do still, you know, they can probably start making a better profit margin on the network if they could kind of, you know, devote all the resources to it. I don't know. But like, if you get to that point, you're abandoning the entire foundation of what the company started as and everything Vince knows so well, the whole TV model. So only thing I can say for certain is that these big changes are not operating in a vacuum. I think that they're going to continue to change the company as time goes on.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting when their next TV deal does come up, because this last time they thought there was going to be a lot of different suitors, and come to find out there was only one, and that was NBC Universal. It's the one they've been dealing with. They didn't get the money that they wanted. And if NBC Universal continues to be the only suitor, then, you know, they can hold them over a barrel when it comes to the amount of money that they're going to give them, which, hey, as much as their footprint is, you know, in the mainstream and on social media and everything, you know, there's only still a certain market when it comes to WWE for networks and their interest. And right now there's only the one place. And so they got to try to make them happy. It's going to be more difficult as ratings continue to go lower, and just trying to keep the deal that they have right now. So a couple last things. So what didn't make the piece? What was edited out?
I mean, a lot of the stuff, I mean, because I spoke to so many people, you know, I think just about everyone that I interviewed was quoted, even if they were anonymous. But again, like just about every topic that I hit on my reporting was included. And I think that's why the piece is so long. You know, I didn't set out to write an 8,500 word piece or an 8,000 plus word piece. It really wasn't something that we were like, okay, yeah, we're definitely going to hit 8,000 words, right? Yeah, for sure. No, it was like, okay, let's just see how it goes. You know, I was thinking more like maybe 4,000 to 5,000, maybe 6 at most. But as I structured the piece, I always try to give my editors, a good amount of info so I can say, if you don't like it, we'll cut it. You know, if it's not necessary, we'll cut it. So, you know, as I was writing, I was like, okay, like I definitely want to include a lot about the network, a lot about the finances, a lot about company culture, a lot about the family, you know, and like a lot of that stuff was included. You know, there is so much like nuts and bolts stuff that I didn't think was super necessary. A lot of the stuff about at WrestleMania, you know, there was some culture stuff that we cut about fans in, you know, in the parking lot, you know, doing their thing, and a lot of that more colorful stuff. And also there was obviously no commentary about the event itself as it went on. Although I did write about that a little bit. It was more just kind of like a one-liner at the very end of the piece about how WrestleMania went. But yeah, I mean, we definitely tried to keep as much in as we could, because we tried to give the fullest picture we could possible. Because again, you're writing for Vice Sports, you're not writing for a wrestling publication. So I wanted to be able to give people not only information that was probably already known to most wrestling fans, to the general reader, so they could kind of understand, you know, the context of this story, but also try to really hone in on all the interviews and let all of these sources really stake their claim, and all these former employees, you know, and really also too, make sure that I give George and Michelle and Paul and everyone else their fair shake in terms of responding to claims that I bring up or things like that. So that was really where we kind of ended up, and we didn't really want to cut too much out because we thought it was all pretty necessary to give a clear and complete picture about how the company's doing and all the things that they've done in the past 7 years. And I really think that the past 7 years since Shane has left has been the biggest, you know, like the biggest change, you know, like I speak a lot about NXT, which I think is great. You know, I really know nothing bad to say about that. And most everyone I spoke to thought it was a really great idea. And Paul's obviously done well with it. So I think that it was much more about not about what we can cut, but about making sure that what we did have in there was as round and as clear and complete as possible.
So what kind of response have you gotten to the piece, especially from people within the company?
WWE has yet to respond, to be honest with you. So what is it now? It's Monday at 5 o'clock. I sent them the piece the second it came out, and I said if they want to talk about it, they're more than welcome, you know, if especially if I got anything wrong, you know. And I did go back to them. I'm like, I want to make sure I'm this is right, you know, a couple of things I fact check with them, because, you know, I don't want to be the guy who's reporting on things that are inaccurate, especially when it comes to things that could be critical. So there was a lot of back and forth as the piece was going through editing. But I haven't heard anything back from them. So I assume that there's no large scale errors. I haven't heard anyone who has been following the company in terms of, smart marks or people who are really, really into the company. No one really pointed out any huge errors. I think one person said that Muhammad Ali didn't fight when he was in
WrestleMania. Right, he just made an appearance, yeah.
And I think I used the word he fought, which I guess is inaccurate, and I apologize. But other than that, I really haven't heard anyone say anything is inaccurate. So we'll see what happens. But if the company does respond, you know, my editors and I will definitely evaluate and see if we have to, you know, put it up on the site, or if they're going to do it themselves, or, you know, but, you know, they could always just keep on going business as usual, and they probably wouldn't heard too much on it.
Right. So have you thought about doing any kind of follow-up, whether that be next year or a few years from now?
Yeah. I mean, when you invest so much time and energy into a subject, you kind of become attached to it. So I think that I will definitely continue to peek in on the company, and see how they're doing. You know, maybe if I dig up some other leads on other things going on within the company, maybe focus on one employee in particular or someone who has a compelling story regarding their time there. You know, I could see myself doing that. But at this point, I don't really know. You know, I like to see them grow the network, and I like to see them succeed. And I'd love to see Shane get back in the mix, maybe take over, some international role with building the company outside of the U.S. But yeah, I'll definitely have my eyes open for them, and then I definitely wish them the best.
That'd be the one person that I hope you get an opportunity to speak with. If you do a follow-up, if you do it on just one particular person, I think on Shane and his ambitions and coming back to the company and even leaving, that would be the one that would really stand out to me.
All right. Well, it's on my to-do list, man.
We'll put it on the to-do list. So, Ian, I really appreciate the time. Everybody should check it out. Just go to Vice Sports, Breaking Kayfabe, an inside look at WWE's unlikely business empire. Check it out. Fantastic read. Really, really detailed. Congratulations on the piece, Ian, and keep up the great work.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Ian Frisch for joining me today. I really appreciate the conversation. Great piece. If you haven't checked it out yet, please go online and read it. Breaking Kayfabe, an inside look at WWE's unlikely business empire. It's on Vice Sports. You can find the direct link for that on Ian's Twitter page. That's at IANFRISCH, Ian Frisch. You can find it there. He's got it pinned to the top of his Twitter page. I'll also tweet it out as well. I'm at Brian Fritz, and you can check it out there. So really nice of Ian to give me the time today to talk about the piece, which is very detailed, very substantive. And I enjoyed it a lot, and I hope he does do a follow-up piece to it. So thanks again to everybody for listening to the podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes and rate and review the podcast. 5 stars, everybody. Go for it. Give me 5 stars. And please share your thoughts about the podcast as well. And hopefully they're nice. You can also find the podcast. We're on Stitcher. We're on SoundCloud, Google Play, the TuneIn app, all over the place. You can get the Between the Ropes podcast. Be listening for later on in the week. Michael and I will be back. We will talk about the week in wrestling. And I'm sure there's going to be plenty coming up when it comes to Raw and SmackDown, and we've got Roadblock End of the Line coming up here, and lots of other things when it comes to the wrestling business. So thanks again, everybody, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time right here, Between the Ropes.